Bye.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Knock Knock High with the Glockum Fleckens. I am Dr. Glockum Flecken, also known as Will Flannery.
I am Lady Glockum Flecken, also known as Kristen Flannery.
I'm in the process of legally changing my name. Oh, I didn't tell you that.
Oh, okay. Well,
just
you know,
kidding. I wouldn't do
it's
that.
It's a pain in the butt. Yeah, I don't see you following through on all the paperwork for
is
that.
Is there a lot of paperwork?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
It's a lot. Yep.
You got to change like all your...
Because it changes everywhere.
You got to change your like driver's license.
You got to do that. You got to do all your credit cards, bank accounts. I mean, literally anything with your name on it. Think of all the things that exist with your name on it.
Why would anybody
it's a lot.
Do that?
That's what I was saying, you know, like 14
Terrible.
Years ago.
So we have a live show coming up.
We sure do.
God, we love the live shows.
They're a lot of fun.
So much fun. And actually, it's good we're talking about this because it got me thinking about it just because of our guest today, Dr. Anthony Chinqui, who's a storyteller. And that's what we do during our live show.
We do. It's a story.
It's like an hour and a change long story that we tell using some
it
characters.
It is a tragicomic, multimedia memoir stage show.
That's right.
I think that covers everything. Oh, I didn't put in the characters. I got to figure out how to work them in.
There's characters in there, too. I have a lot of dressing changes I have to do during this show.
It's true.
Which we've got it down by now because we did three very successful shows in Southern California in December, and now we're trickling out some more.
Yes, that is right.
So
we have one this weekend, and then don't worry, we will have more later in the year, and we will have details coming out.
March 24th at 7 p.m. in Irvine, at the Irvine Improv. All right, we did a show there in December, and it was so much fun. Sold out very quickly, so make sure you try to get tickets if you haven't already. But if not, like we're taking this elsewhere too. So
we're going on the road later this year.
We're trying to nail down dates and venues and it's we do have like a family and
jobs.
Like jobs and stuff. So I've got to work around that, but we're trying to work around it. So we're talking maybe like 10, 12. Cities, something like that.
We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll have all the info on our website.
As soon as we know.
GlockandFlecken.com/live.
As soon as we know, you're going to know. Yeah, GlockandFlecken.com/live. Check that out. But March 24th, 7 p.m., Irvine Improv. Come on out. And our guest today is a guy that's done a lot. He went through otolaryngology training.
Mm-hmm.
So
residency.
Went to med school, residency, practiced for a few years, and then decided to leave medicine to find himself a little bit more.
Well,
to pursue
his creative side.
To pursue his creative side, which medicine tries to get rid of.
It sure does.
And I'm glad, and really it's to the benefit of so many people because he has worked on, done some writing on TV, Grey's Anatomy.
Yep. The Resident.
The Resident. And also, though, it came out with a book last year.
Yes.
Called
I Can't Save You.
I Can't Save You. It's a critically acclaimed book. Like you go on New York Times, Washington Post. They've talked about this book. Fantastic memoir.
He's an excellent writer, a very creative storyteller.
Yes. He's also an award-winning storyteller with The Moth. We talked a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Hey, God, I really want to. We should do it. We should get
Ooh,
we should go
do,
to the
do,
Moth.
Do they have like partner Moth?
No, I don't
Can
know.
Can you do it? I have only ever seen solo performances.
Well, we could just do,
we'll
our,
have to draw straws.
Do our own. No, just do our own separate things. You know, our recounting of our story is quite different.
It's different. You don't remember any of the parts that I talk about. So
exactly.
I call dibs on those.
Exactly. All right. So we had a wonderful conversation with Dr. Chinqui. Should we get to it?
Yes.
All right, here we go. Today's episode is brought to you by the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience, or DAX for short. This is AI-powered ambient technology that helps physicians be more efficient and reduces clinical documentation burden. To learn more about how DAX Copilot can help you reduce burnout and restore the joy of practicing medicine, stick around after the episode or visit nuance.com/discover-DAX. That's nuance.com/discover-DAX. All right, we are here with Dr. Anthony Chinqui. Tony, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Guys, I'm so thrilled. Thank you so much for having me.
This is really exciting. But I got to start with I've been thinking about this for a while now. All right. So can we, because you did, you went through training in otolaryngology. Mm-hmm. Can we rank the five senses?
Oh boy.
Let's just get this. Let's just get this out of the way. I'm an ophthalmologist. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you trained in otolaryngology. I feel like we got to do this. We got. Okay. Let's go. Okay.
Let's talk senses. All right. Let's refresh the five senses for everybody out there, maybe including me. So we got what? Sight.
Yep.
Hearing. Mm-hmm. Touch.
Yep. Taste.
And smell.
And smell. Yep.
Ooh. Okay. So okay, let's, ranking. Well,
tell me what you would go with. We'll see how close we are.
I mean, if we're ranking as far as like which ones we think is like the dopest sense or which one yeah. we could not live without, like we wouldn't want to say we can't live without, but which one yeah. we really don't want to lose?
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Okay. Exactly.
I mean, personally, I'm a big fan of eyesight. And yeah. I know that, yeah. you know, it's not part of my specialty anymore. Historically, it was.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go with eyesight at the top. Then I'm going to go with hearing because I love
you understand the
world
the importance
me.
Of and the inner... The inner, the, outer, and middle ear. It's all
yeah,
very
all, all the segments, and I'm a music lover and audiophile, so that's important to me. I'm going to go with smell over taste,
okay.
because if you lose your sense of smell, you lose your sense of taste also. So,
oh, right. They kind of go hand in hand. There
they
you
go
yeah.
hand in hand, okay. so I'm just going to keep the smell if I can keep them. I'm okay with touch being at the bottom. I often think about life without the sense of touch and the shenanigans I could get into, but I don't know. That's
a bit much higher risk of burning yourself and just generally just injuries or
yeah, you like feel awesome until like you have lots of festering wounds that you don't know about. But,
I thought right. for sure we'd have some arguments, but I feel exactly the same way.
Oh, I don't.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're different. What are yours? What are your five?
I would still probably put eyesight at the top, but I don't know. I could do without smell and taste. Sure, take them. Like, just get them out of here.
You probably have touch higher up.
I have touch higher up. And then, you know, I was thinking I could do without my hearing because I get really overstimulated by noises. Like, it's stressful to me when there's a lot of noise happening. But then you made the point about music, and I listen to a lot of podcasts and audiobooks, and I am a podcaster. So, you know, that might be a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, there's workarounds, right?
But, of course, there's workarounds. There's ways to make life wonderful. With lots of any of these things.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could go through that because I've certainly had my fair share of arguments with otolaryngologists and about this. So, you know, I think we're all coming, we all have very valid arguments there.
Yeah. I'd like to be able to turn my hearing down though. Like that'd be nice.
Just
like a hearing
crank
aid,
it down.
But in the opposite direction.
Well, I think they have that. They're called noise canceling earphones.
I have them. That's why I use them a lot. You'll see me down in the living room in the evenings with the family around.
Exist.
And
wow.
I've got my noise canceling headphones on, just being a mom.
You have just invented technology that already exists.
Wow.
No, I want to be able to just like turn my ears. I don't want to have to wear.
Oh, where's? I see.
Yeah.
I see. Well,
I just want to turn my ears down.
Turn your actual ear down.
I don't think we got that.
No, that'd be nice though.
No, we'll
I'd
work
like to
on
be able
that.
To turn them all down a bit, except for my eyesight. I could turn that up a bit. I'm pretty blind.
Yeah, that would be nice for you. So, Tony, let's go back and I want to just give our listeners just an idea of who you are, where you came from, your upbringing that really kind of led you into initially a career in medicine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's do the short version. And if you guys find yourselves intrigued by any nuggets, you can stop
sure
me
we
or
will.
Just wave your hands around and we'll circle back. But so I'm from New York City. I grew up in Brooklyn. My family is kind of a West Indian immigrant family. So my dad's side is from Jamaica. My mom's side is from Trinidad. That's sort of one of the mixes you'll see a lot of in Brooklyn, New York. A lot of West Indian immigrants there. But I was just always a smart kid. And in that culture that I come from, as is the case with many immigrant cultures, when you're the smart one, you know, there's only a couple of paths that your community expects you to take. And it's not even like they pressured me. It's just that's all I kind of knew. It's just doctor, lawyer, engineer, you know, those are the big ones if you're the smart kid in the family. So I, you know, went, just gravitated towards doctor, medicine. I could do the math, I could do the science, and, you know, kept that up through, you know, high school. And for college, I was at Harvard and I was trying to do all that stuff, just keep it going as well. Realized I really loved teaching while I was in college. Did a lot of those programs, but kept up the pre-med stuff. And then,
Now, did you maintain this undercurrent of artistry? Because you like to write, obviously. We're going to talk about your book. You love storytelling and entertaining. And so how did you keep that alive? Because that can easily get kind of squashed in medical education when you're on that path.
Yes. Glad you brought that up, because it did get squashed and it's very sad. On the way, like growing up, I was super artsy. Like I'm a very artsy, performy kind of guy. So I love playing music and acting and singing and dancing and all that stuff. I was in musicals, and in college I was in a cappella, of course. And just, you know,
you're telling us way too much. You know, we don't have any background music on this, so we might have to. I have a game for us to play later, but we may switch over to just having you a cappella something.
We'll do the serenade. I love that stuff so much. And it kind of, I didn't realize how much I needed it in my life until it started to get squeezed out. And especially when I went to medical school, and, you know, just you're around the hardcore science nerds, you know, like that's where you're at. And you get to a point where if you engage in anything that people can deem a distraction from your studies, then you're kind of looked down upon. Mm-hmm. And so the things I really love to do, I kind of had to put in a corner and start keeping quiet. And that really started in med school and extremely so in residency training. Where there were like actual consequences to, like, if they hear you were like reading a book for pleasure instead of studying, you know, that goes on your permanent record. So it's super cool. So yeah, I don't do anything fun anymore. But yeah, it's just, those are parts of me that were always really important that I had to start neglecting in order to succeed in medicine, which I didn't realize just how much it was harming me until, you know, the medicine wasn't enough and I was really struggling.
Yeah. And I want to explore that a little bit, because residency is, no matter what residency program you're doing, it's challenging. It's very, very difficult and can lead you to a dark place in life at times. And so what was it that kind of, when did this, if there was a switch that flipped that kind of told you, okay, I need to either leave medicine, or I need something to change to allow me to explore that artistic side of my life that's so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it was like, I remember it's a very specific moment. And it was in the middle of residency, and it was kind of at my rock bottom of residency, not just because of the workload and the lifestyle, the experience of residency, but also like I've lived with chronic depression my whole life. And it kind of, you know, I haven't always managed it. I haven't always known to manage it or how to. But I, over the course of my life, you know, I've had these really intense periods of being really depressed. And I had one of those periods halfway through residency training, you know, to the point that I was just, you know, barely showing up at work. And, you know, I failed my step three, which you're really not supposed to. And it's like, you know, typically, you know, people can pass and not worry about it. But I didn't study at all. And because I was so, you know, outside of myself. And
this is this is surgical residency. How many years is otolaryngology? It's like 6 years or something. It's a long residency, 5 years.
Yeah. So it's long. This is second year, start having this stuff. And then at some point, you know, after I failed step three, they told me that I couldn't work anymore until I passed it. And so I was given this indefinite leave of absence. And during that time, you know, I really had to figure out like what it was that I wanted to do with all of this. Like, what was I killing myself for, you know? And then I remembered just how much I loved telling stories. And I really always have, you know, in whatever capacity. And I've always been told that I was pretty good at it. And so I was just like, maybe what I'm going to take out of this experience is the story that I want to tell. And I want to tell a story about residency and about training that doesn't sanitize kind of what it is, what it has been for me, and what I know it is for lots of my friends who are going through it. Because I realized I'd never read a book like that, that takes the chance to make the author, the doctor, look bad, you know, and and really, you know, talk about the really difficult and grimy parts of training and the grimy parts of ourselves that we find along the way. And I just thought that honesty could be really helpful to other folks. And so from that point, you know, I kind of used that as my guiding light, you know, at the end of the tunnel to get through the next couple of years, and just started just taking note of like moments that I knew were formative as they were happening, and just like writing them down. Or, you know, when I'm dealing with something and like songs come to mind, I start writing the song down. I took a lot of photographs, you know, that I felt were emblematic of the moments that I was going through, and didn't know how it was all going to come together. But, you know, just the act of tapping back in to, you know, something that's really helped me understand the world, this my artistic side, was enough, you know, to kind of pull me through.
Yeah, it's interesting, because then you're not just doing residency anymore. Now you're doing research. Now you're in a project. You know, now you're living your story that you're going to be writing. So you're doing what you're doing for the story, not just for, you know, the piece of paper at the end. So that's kind of interesting. I think a lot of people. I didn't go to med school, but I did go to a really rigorous grad school program, and decided halfway through, or a little over halfway through, that was not going to be the life for me. And so I get it. A lot of people in med school, I think, you know, similar thing, or even during residency, or even out when you're out and you're practicing and you're like, you know what, this is just not the life for me. It's either not what I thought it was, or it's just not for me anymore. And then it can feel so bleak because so much goes into it. And there's so much, you know, shaping, not just, you know, of your skills, but of your mindset and your beliefs about the world. And, you know, like what you're saying, like if you're reading for pleasure, that's somehow bad. Like you get into these twisted mindsets.
You could be operating.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it feels like there's too much to lose to be able to do anything else. And then that puts people in these really desperate situations that sometimes, you know, don't turn out well. So I think it's so powerful to hear stories like yours of somebody that says, you know what, I have medicine, but medicine is not going to be enough. And so what can I do?
Yeah. And I think it's just, I mean, it's the fallacy of sunken costs, right? I mean, you put in so much time and money, the hundreds of thousands of whatever.
And a sense of identity even.
And it's like in this particular profession it becomes part of your identity for better or worse. And to consider walking away from it. And I've talked, because I've kind of become this patron saint of doctors who leave, and I've gotten a lot of people reach out to me and call and just like, is it okay? Is it okay to walk away? Or
Is there life after medicine?
Yeah. And it's just like, you got to remember that there's no experience that you go through that is a waste. You didn't waste those years. Whatever you gained from that time, you're going to bring to whatever else you choose to do. And it's such a rich and unique and important experience for you that you're going to make, you know, whatever it is you go into next really meaningful because of it. So don't worry about, you know, don't think about it as, you know, I wasted all those years and all that money. Like what you got to worry about wasting is, you know, the life you have left. I mean, it's just, I mean, you know, we talk about depression and, you know, we don't have to get dark, but we can be real. Like, you know, I dealt with suicidal thoughts and, you know, really, honestly, I think I'm alive just because of luck a lot of the time. Like, there were times when I was just very careless with my life when I was really depressed. And that was kind of how I engaged in it. And a lot of times when that carelessness really could have gone one way or another. And then when you come out and the fog clears and you realize, like, man, you know, how flimsy is all this stuff? How quickly can it all get taken away? And am I going to spend these minutes, these moments, you know, not trying to be happy, not trying to be fulfilled? I mean, we all deserve it. And the profession shouldn't make us feel like we don't.
Did you have people along the way when you were in residency that you felt you could reach out for help, or that tried to help you? Or did that not really exist where you were?
Yeah. So I think it was difficult for me where I was, because I was in Detroit. I'm not from Detroit. I don't have any family there. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people in the Midwest and in those programs are from the Midwest. They have family kind of nearby. Yeah. I didn't.
But even in the medical, like in the hospital, uh-huh. like you're, you know.
Yeah, I had friends, but I didn't trust them. That's kind of a trick that residency plays on you. Mm-hmm. You know, like I didn't, especially like people in my program, I didn't trust them to know things about me, because I thought, is this just going to come back around? They're going to talk. The world is so small. And my friends who were, you know, in different specialties, you know, we were all in tough places in one way or another. And so I think what we mostly used each other for were distractions. Yeah, that's the easiest way. And so we didn't dig into the stuff that all of us in some way were really struggling with, because we didn't have time. We were tired. It's easier just to get drunk and, you know, do silly stuff. You
know, probably instead not of getting the best thing you want to do when you're having, when you're depressed, right?
Yeah. So none of us,
it's like a band-aid.
We all think we're smart enough to outsmart ourselves. So,
Well, it's so tricky too, because in medicine and especially during residency, you know, there's this culture that you can't have a weakness, you can't have a sick day, you can't have anything wrong with you, because if you need to tap out for a bit, all that does is put more work on everyone else around you. And so how could you, you know, I think it takes a very special environment and a very intentional culture to be able to create a culture where you can go talk to your resident, your fellow residents or your program director or whatever, and say, hey, I'm having a hard time. Because if you don't intentionally create that, then it's just, you're just making life harder for everybody else if you need a break. So I can see how it feels like you have to keep that to yourself, you know, because what option do you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you started to explore, you know, be yourself for the most part. You know, you had this opportunity. At what point did you say, you know, I need to leave. I need to stop, you know, get out of medicine.
I started my first job after residency. And I knew within a few months that, okay, I'm not staying at this job forever. Like that, just something about the clinic to OR to clinic to OR for the rest of my life. I couldn't do it. And so I stayed there for 3 years, and then I quit. And I was thinking, you know, maybe I need a different venue, you know, a different institution, mm-hmm. you know, just to keep doctoring, and looked for some opportunities. Nothing was quite panning out. So I was just going to take some time, and, you know, I had my savings. It was all good. And then one day I saw this advertisement on Facebook to be a medical advisor for Grey's Anatomy. And like as an intern, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm quitting my job. I'm going to have a few months to myself. So
like,
and I
just
in LA.
Did an internship. It can't be any worse than that.
Yeah. So I was just like kind of, you know, girding my loins for internship number two, whatever that may look like. And it was just the coolest thing, because it was basically me in the writer's room of Grey's Anatomy helping the writers put the medicine into the show.
Yeah.
Because the writers don't know it at all. And so, you know, just to be around that, and I had no idea that that was a profession really that people could do. And I was just like, what if I like want to do this? Like, can I get down with you guys? And it was the great thing, like they have such a great writer's room, and a lot of the writers there have had full careers in different things before becoming writers. And so they were really warm and helpful and kind of gave me tips on what to do and what classes to take and all this sort of stuff. And so, you know, I started chatting with some folks, started writing on my own, and ended up getting a job as a writer on The Resident when it was on the air. And just not even just a medical consultant, but an actual
episode writer
on the show.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I was just like, okay, this is awesome. I kind of love this. And what if I just do this? Let's just do it and see what happens. So So yeah, that's when I was just like, you know what?
Did you have to move out to LA for this, or were you?
Well, when I was, my job that I had was in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
So you were already living there.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, it wasn't by accident that I got my first job in Los Angeles. I kind of was just, you know, rolling the dice. I was like, hey, I haven't lived there before. I'd love to live there. And it's near this entertainment industry. And
yeah, yeah.
I don't know what may come out of it, but let's just be nearby.
You were intrigued by it. Yeah. You're like, yeah. Maybe you know, let's see some opportunities could come up there. So
it did. It worked out. And,
it's awesome.
You know, when people ask me if I miss it, you know, it's just, I answer so quickly that I don't.
medicine, you mean?
Not a bit.
If I miss medicine, just, I'm just fine.
These medical shows, though, they still struggle with the chest compressions. I'm just saying, like it's. I'm sure
there's a few things.
I'm sure you've been banging your head against the wall at times. Like, come on, we need to, you know, pick up the pace here a little bit.
Yeah, no. Well, here's the fun thing about writing on medical shows, and when you're a doctor, is that you got to figure out where you want to draw your line, right? Because one thing about being in writers' rooms with creative people is saying no, you can't do that isn't a helpful thing to add to a conversation. So what you're always trying to do is be like, okay, let's see what you want to go for emotionally, and I can see what I can do about helping the medicine meet you there. And then, you know, you got to do things like compress things for time, or you know, like labs that may take 4 days to really come back. You got to get back in 2 minutes. And, you know, this doctor, because we only have so many doctors in the hospital, has to be both hospitalist and surgeon and palliative care. And let's just, you know,
the house MD model.
Yeah. The house MD. But I always thought about it as like, okay, as long as we're not being irresponsible with the messaging, you know, then we can, if we got to gloss over some specifics that only, you know, the people really in the know are going to notice, you know, like, it's okay. Because if we're teaching people about, you know, these are the important things you have to know about being an end-stage diabetic, you know, or, you know, teaching people about, we had this episode that I did where we're talking about fat shaming in a hospital from your doctors, you know, and how that can affect your health and how you have to advocate for yourself. You know, like that's the important part of it. And if we got to, you know, gloss over the little stuff, like there's a whole bunch of, you know, intubations that are just sloppy, but you know, I'll be like, you know what? It's okay. Let's keep it moving. I don't want to stress everybody out. Let's get to the wholesome moral of the story.
Yeah, you're not actually doing surgery. You're just making a TV show.
I mean, you can't wait 72 hours for culture results to come back and sensitivities, right? So, and
after
you
the commercial break, we got that.
And so, you know, if you every now and then you might irritate like an interventional cardiologist out there somewhere, but it makes
you know what
sense.
They do get right though is I've not once ever seen an ophthalmologist in an ICU. So
that's true.
They are doing that right.
Have you written any ophthalmology stuff? Any eyeball stuff?
You know, I try. It's hard to get ophthalmologists onto TV, and that's something I hope to rectify in my career.
May I present one to
reach,
you?
Reach out. I'm happy to help.
I was like, listen, I know a guy.
Yeah.
Knows the eyeballs. Like, he'll just pass through. He'll be great.
I'm saying if we could just, I would love to get some representation of eyeball land. I think it matters.
And we don't want you guys slipping through the cracks. Yeah. Absolutely.
At least just to help people understand what an ophthalmologist is. That's all. That's like bottom line. Let's just.
I thought you were going to say Visine, but.
Oh, I mean, if we could have a Visine poison patient. I don't know if House ever did that, but
I don't know.
You know, that's like a true story. That's like something that actually happened.
Oh man,
I know.
Anyway, all right, let's take a quick break. I want to come back and talk about storytelling the moth, all the work you've done there. So we'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Old news, but good news. We're coming back to the Irvine Improv on Sunday, March 24th for our show, Wife and Death.
That's right. We're going to talk about the time you died.
And came back to life.
It'll be a tragicomic, multimedia, memoir, stage show extravaganza.
And some of my characters might show up, too. You'll just have to come and check it out and see for yourself. To buy tickets, click the link in the description below, or you can visit glockenflecken.com/live. We'll see you there. Hey, Kristen.
What's up?
I got to tell you about Precision.
Tell me.
This is really cool. It's the first ever EHR integrated infectious disease AI platform.
Well, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's for any specific patient. It'll automatically highlight better antibiotic regimens.
Okay, so it can maybe help you treat the patient better and then also gets at this antibiotic stewardship issue?
Exactly. It basically empowers clinicians to save more lives while reducing burnout, just making their jobs easier.
Nice.
To see a demo, go to precision.com/KKH. That's precision spelled with an X instead of an E. So precision.com/KKH. All right, we are back with Dr. Anthony Chinqui. And so, Tony, tell us, I'm fascinated by the work you've done on the moth. You're an award-winning moth participant. Storyteller.
Yeah, award-winning storyteller.
That's awesome. So give us a little insight into, well, how'd you get started with the moth?
Mm. Yeah, so I got started. I have two parts of my life that have been moth related. And the first one was actually back in residency, back in Detroit, like after I had my realization that I kind of told you guys about, that I needed art back in my life. I was like, okay, where can I find it in this city? Is there anything to kind of tide me over? I was like, let me go to like this open mic or like this and that. Mm-hmm. And then I heard about the moth, which is just a storytelling competition that's held once a month in pretty much every major city in the country. And it's usually at a cool lounge or bar or whatever. And you go there and you put your name in a hat and they pick 10 people out of the hat and you have 5 minutes to get up on stage and just tell a story, hopefully on the theme that they chose for the night. Mm-hmm. And I heard about this and I had never been to one before, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to get on stage and I am going to pick a story and I'm going to practice it so that it sounds spontaneous when I do it.
Right.
Because that's how I like to be spontaneous, is very well rehearsed.
Prepare to be spontaneous. Yeah.
So I went and I invited some friends and I got up there. Another buddy of mine got up there too. And we told these stories and it's just the best. This little crowd and just everyone's normal. They're laughing. We're having fun. Some folks cry during like these stories, like they run the gamut. And so I did that one. And like, there's a little competition at these local ones. And I came in first place in that one. So I got invited to the All Detroit Once a Year Slam, which was so just awesome. Like it was at the Fox Theater in Detroit and just sold out, you know,
big
theater. And it was beautiful. And it was so much fun. The idea that I was hooked. Yeah. And
do you get to keep developing the same story as you move up through the ranks there, or do you have to come up with a different story every time?
Well, now that I've actually in the last year since my book came out, my publishers got in touch with the moth people and they were like, hey, like, what if you come back and you tell the story from your book? I adapted one of the stories from my book to get on stage and tell at what they call the Grand Slams. So basically it's like they're best of the best storytellers. They go from city to city and, you know, it's always a big fun deal. It's usually just like five people. And I've told my story three times in three different venues, and same story. But, you know, as you perform it, you kind of figure out what works. It's like refining, you know, stand-up material. You know what I mean?
Right.
So by the end, by the last time I did it, I was like, all right, I'm really like rocking this at this point. And there's some folks who tell the same story like 10, 12 times, you know, just they take them out on tour and people just love it. And the only time you're forced to stop telling one story is when they kind of retire it, when they put it up on their podcast.
Right,
and so everyone hears it. So you got to come up with something. But it's just such a wonderful organization. It's so sweet.
And the idea is that these are, I mean, you prepare for it, but they're not like, you know, you don't memorize it and rehearse it over and over again. And isn't that like, they don't want you reading the story, right?
Right. Extemporaneous. Is reading the story, but by the time, like if you're telling the same story a lot,
You got it.
You know the story.
It's your story, right?
So, it's just like, and just, but they don't want you to feel stilted. They wanted you to feel like a conversation, like you're around a campfire. And so you kind of maintain, you know, that sense of kind of playfulness with the audience and kind of staying loose out there. So
I've never been to a moth event. I'd love to go.
Yeah, we should go.
They have one in Portland?
I'm sure they do.
I don't know. They probably
100% they have one in Portland.
It's a bigger literary city than it. You know, than you might think.
That's true.
It's Portland. If it like, but yeah, it's
got all sorts of arty stuff. Yeah,
it is.
It is quite crunchy.
So did you, I guess, springboard from doing that into writing a book? How did you, at what point were you like, oh, I got to just write all this down and publish it? Like,
So the book stuff was also an idea I had in the middle of residency. And so all the notes and things I was taking for the next, you know, few years, I was like, you know, I think I can make something out of this. And so after I graduated, I just started writing it from the beginning, and I didn't quite know what it was going to be. I was like, is this going to be like an expose of, you know, medical training and how trash it is? Or is it going to be something different? And I realized that what I wanted to do was tell like kind of a much more personal story about my journey through, and hopefully, you know, by making it real specific, I could make it ultimately more universal to folks, if that makes sense. And so I started writing in 2016, and the book came out in 2023. So it took a really long time to write it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you decide whether to go like traditional publishing, self-publishing? I think a lot of people are thinking about writing a book these days. That's a big question.
Yeah. I mean, I think self-publishing is always always an option. But I think we all want to try to get, you know, in with a publisher who can, you know, use their money to try to sell your book instead of your own. But the process of getting there was pretty long. I mean, this first step was finding a literary agent. And, you know, me not knowing anybody in the literary world, you know, I just looked up how to do it on the internet. And it was
just basically a YouTube video for how to find it.
Just Google.
Yeah, there's Google. Like, there's quite a few. And it's just basically you learn how to write a little letter talking about you and the idea you have for your book. And if you've written any of it, you know, you attach that bit and then you just send out blind emails to folks and see if they get back to you. And oftentimes agents either get back to you in like 3 months after you send it, or they never get back to you at all. And so you just keep throwing it at the wall and seeing what sticks. And I think I was looking for an agent for about a full calendar year, just getting the rejections. And I think I sent query letters to about 60 or 70 people. And
it's like applying for residency.
You throw it all at the wall and, you know, you try not to let the failure get you down. There was one agent who really connected with it and thought it was cool. And we just went from there.
Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah,
I have, you know, dreams of writing a book one day, but I don't know when I'm going to do that.
Podcasting keeps getting in the way.
Yeah, parenting, you know, little things.
Just a little stuff. No big deal. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, the only way, like, yeah, there's all the logistics.
You find reasons not
to. How to do it and how to find an agent, all that stuff. None of that matters. You just got to write something.
Yeah.
You know? And it's, you know, you make it a practice, write a little bit or think of some ideas, you know, you make that your, give yourself 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day and just see where it leads you. You know?
Are you still writing for TV? Are you?
Yes. Well, at least attempting to. Attempting to work on the television adaptation of my book. Hoping that we have some cool news to share about that sometime soon. But you know, last year was the Hollywood writer strike, which was just a wonderful and stressful time for everybody, just being out of work for 5 months. And now that it's done, it's even harder to find work. So, it's a challenge, but I'm still trying to come up with my own ideas, things that have nothing to do with medicine and stretching my wings, you know, as a storyteller and still love it.
Who do you want to play you in the TV show?
Oh man, you know, it's just, you know, take your pick of just the most handsome and charismatic people.
Yeah, that's right.
I think you should go straight for Denzel.
I mean, you know, like It's funny.
I'm sure that's a possibility.
We grew up and kind of, I think in our heads, at least in mine, Denzel is always kind of like 30 years old and like just still handsome just and just nailing it. Yep. And he's not like the 70-year-old guy who just is making it look easy. But I mean, if Denzel wanted to give a crack at it, you don't say no.
That's right. It could be a retrospective, him telling the story. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, you go Denzel or bust. I think that's very smart.
Yeah. Shoot high.
So the book is called I Can't Save You. And before we start wrapping up, you shared with us a few stories just from your life, because we like to tell stories in this podcast. And so you have one it's in your book, if you wouldn't mind sharing, about your first day as an on-call intern.
Oh yeah. So this is a fun one. Let's see if I can do this quickly. So yeah, my first day on call was the 4th of July.
That's terrible. That's a terrible first day on call.
Right into the deep end.
It is just into the deep end. And I'm just like, cool. The most explodey and fiery holiday we have. Just get me in there. And I was on the plastic surgery service. So plastic surgery in the hospital means, in addition to face stuff, they also take care of hands sometimes. And we were the hand specialists for the day. And I got a call from the ER while I'm, hiding huddled away in my call room, like willing my pager into silence. And they call and just like, yeah, we got this guy with a dislocated finger, was riding his bike. He fell off. We can't get it back in. We've tried. We've had attendings try to pop it back. We've had other people. We just figured, now's the time for the hand specialist. And I'm just like, I mean, yeah, sure. You should totally call the hand specialist. Yeah. What are you calling me for? So hand specialist was me. And I was like, cool. Never seen a dislocated anything in my life.
This is going to go well.
And so, yeah. So I was like, but they want me to try. And I was like, well, is this one of those times when I just call my senior resident who's clearly out at a barbecue to come into the hospital and like help me do my very first consult I've ever got? And I was like, you know what?
Like 0 for 1.
Yeah. I was like, you know what? Absolutely not. I'm a step up right now. What's the worst that could happen? Like, he'll continue flapping the breeze. So I got
just have a wonky finger for a while.
Yeah, he'll have a wonky finger, no big deal. And so I got onto YouTube and I just typed in how to fix dislocated finger. And I studied in a YouTube rabbit hole for a solid 10 minutes and just went downstairs and I was just like, just giving off the aura of someone confidence. Who knew what they were doing, because that's the most important thing is just, appearing confident, even if you don't know what you're doing. And so I went in and I, numbed it up. I just went through the steps in my head so many times.
You set the laptop down next to the patient. Started up
YouTube
video.
Hold on, man.
I got to
get the right tab going. No big deal. Yeah.
But yeah, I went in there and I just like was holding my breath the whole time, like trying not to poop my trousers, and managed to pop it back in.
Nice.
And the guy knew it immediately and he loved it. And I was like, hey.
That's a win.
I knew I was nailing. He just gave me a big hug and I like held on to him like inappropriately long. And then just like, as I was leaving, I was like, saw the attendings who had like failed. And I was like, hey man, everything worked out fine. Call me if you have any questions.
Ooh, got cocky.
At that point, you were thinking, oh, this medicine stuff isn't that hard.
Yeah. Oh, right? I'm going to breeze through.
I love that it
best.
Did not come from the Harvard education. It came from YouTube.
That's right.
The knowledge.
Absolutely. So yeah, that was my first day as a doctor responsible for other people.
That is hilarious. I bet that happens so much too. I wonder how much of medical education these days is YouTube.
Well, I mean, I have... I remember stories from my attendings in residency who were, they trained probably 20 years ago or so, but they had, actual textbooks open.
Yeah.
Like while doing procedures, like minor procedures. So, I mean, it's just the newest version of that.
Exactly.
So,
that's it.
And to everybody listening who might be horrified, that this happened,
rightfully horrified. This is not a good thing you want to hear about doctors.
Just keep in mind, like, this was not a life or death situation. There's appropriate supervision, especially in July.
Yes.
There's a lot of people looking out. Because
for
me, again, like my first rotation was ICU as an intern. And so I started on nights.
I remind you, he's an ophthalmologist.
Yeah. Now, at that point, I did have some
you had some brain smarts.
I had some general medical knowledge still rolling around inside my head. But the other story you shared with us, Tony, was just which made me laugh out loud alone by myself, was a story about just how poor you were in residency. Mm-hmm. What did you do? We can all relate to that.
Like, it does not pay well.
Yeah, it doesn't pay well. And I wasn't from a family that learned much about money management. And so I was living above my means and also, well, just completely broke, you know, redlining the old checking account. And so I was at the point sometimes where, you know, to pay for a gallon of gas in my car to get to work, I was out of money. And like, you know, the debit card was an overdraft. So I had to pay in loose change for gas. And so I was like, cool, let me, you know, find, you know, enough quarters and dimes and whatever. But, you know, for some reason, in my travels around the country, you know, I had a jar of change that I just always kept with me. Yeah. But it was also like my jar of thumbtacks that I also kept with me whenever I moved anywhere. So I just kept them together because that's naturally where I did it. So when it was time to pay for gas, it was just basically reaching into the thumbtack jar and painfully and bloodily pulling out loose change, which I would then slap onto the gas station counter in shame. But you know, you get a couple gallons in your car, and you can pretend to your colleagues
I'll tell you what you could have used that money for. Buying a separate jar for your thumbtacks.
A second jar. Yeah. No, that's the kind of foresight that came to me only later on in adulthood.
Yeah. Although I would argue it might be a good money management strategy, because then you've got to really need that money to be willing to go surfing through the bucket of thumbtacks.
Oh, that's good.
To access it.
Yeah. Just
it's a little bit of like classical pain. Conditioning there for
saving your money. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't even thinking straight. I wasn't like, oh man, I really should like get a tetanus shot tomorrow, because I don't know how long these
how many thumbtacks did you need? What were you posting?
I mean, you know, when you move and you take all your thumbtacks out. This is back when like I was in young man mode and all my artwork was just posters, like,
yeah,
you know, oh,
yeah,
the Bob Marley, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So like, I just had a lot of thumbtacks.
I'm just imagining thousands of thumbtacks in your house, in your apartment.
Yeah.
Just I was holding up everything. That bookshelf behind you, it's hard for me to see, but I think there might be a lot of thumbtacks holding thing up.
Just
so.
countless dozens of thumbtacks. Yeah, so that's my painful story.
That's such a great story about, I mean, because, you know, we could relate to just not having any money. And you're already in, at least in our case, you know, $250,000,
$300,000
in debt.
Right, student loan debt.
I still remember during my orientation in med school, we had a financial aid presentation, and he was asking, or the big financial aid advisor was asking like personal finance questions and would throw out ramen packets to people who got the right answer.
Oh,
and
wow.
I remember thinking, I am about to go in $200,000 in debt. This is going to save me. This is what it's gonna take. Yet I did it. I was so excited. I got one of those packets, and
I'm so glad
probably
you did.
Ate it.
It was my dinner one night.
It's
so
delicious. Yeah. Oh my gosh, the things we go through.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So tell everybody, you know, where they can find your book, and anything else you
what
want
you're up to
know.
Now yeah. that it's published.
Yeah, no. So the book came out in April of 23. So it's available wherever books are sold, at your local bookstores. Try to support them. Also, if you're an Amazon Barnes Noble person, go buy it there too. It's there. The audiobook is also available. I hear it's very good because I do the narration.
So
that was super fun. And I've heard that people dig it. So if you want to hear me tell you about my silly life, then
how long did that take?
The audiobook that took about a week in the studio. Okay. We did like 8-hour days.
I always wondered that.
8 yeah. hours of just reading your yeah, own
just
book.
You. Yeah. Your own book and just hearing yourself mess up words like yeah. linoleum. Because I realized, like, wow, that's maybe the word I say the most in my book is a linoleum. And you hear yourself say linoleum enough times, you start right. to think you're going
it, like,
nuts.
Stops being a word yeah. in your mind. Yeah.
It's like, did I make this up?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it felt weird. But yeah, it was like a week in the studio. It was a lot.
Oh, that's great. And yeah. are you, and so what are you up to next? What's in store for you? I obviously have the TV show you're trying to get off the ground.
Yeah. Trying to do that sort of stuff. It's basically, I'm just working on creative stuff, trying to get some new things off the ground. So hopefully this year will be a fruitful year in that regard. And there'll be fun news upcoming.
Do you spend any time on social media? Or do you try to stay away?
I don't participate in it all that much, but gotcha. I'm always lurking. So yeah, I'm on the X/Twitter. I'm at CQ_MD. Or if you just look for my name, Anthony Chinqui, I'm there. And I'm also on Instagram. If you look up my name again, Anthony Chinqui, you'll find me on there.
Great. And again, the book is I Can't Save You. Definitely go grab it, and it's fantastic. By the way, like people are like raving about it, the reviews of this book. So congratulations on all the success from that.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful. I'm just glad people are finding it and relating to it.
I think it's you got a story that a lot of people can relate to. I mean,
yeah.
especially not. I mean, not just people in healthcare, right? Not just people in medicine, but a lot of people can relate to your story. And as far as medicine goes, I mean, it's a tough time right now, right? Mm-hmm. Morale is like, I feel like it's never been lower just among yeah. healthcare professionals. And so,
yeah, we need to see some examples of, you know, yeah. how can you take your medical degree, experience, education, whatever it is that you have, and use it to make your life whatever it is that you want your life to be.
Yeah. Just find yourself and what makes you happy and be true to yourself and all of those things, just awesome lessons. And so thank you for putting that out there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for all you guys yeah. do. I follow all you do. And I think your journey to this point has just been so wonderful. It's wonderful to see. And I'm glad that you're giving back in all the ways that you're trying to. It's just great. So thank you guys for all you do.
I don't have an otolaryngologist yet as a character. I'm still Ooh. Working on that. Yeah. So
maybe you can have him write it for you.
Exactly.
You need to collaborate. Have him write it for you.
That's right. Yeah, I'm talking to a writer right here. So, all right. Well, thanks again for coming on, Tony. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Have a great one.
Hey, Kristen.
Yeah.
How many mites is too many mites?
For me, one.
Well, I have 8.
That's way too many.
That's a lot of mites, right?
No one wants that many mites.
You know where you find these guys?
I'm afraid to know.
On your eyelids.
Yeah. Oh, I don't want that.
I know, but like if you ever have red, itchy, irritated eyelids, or if you get a crusty, flaky buildup on your eyelashes, could be because of Demodex blepharitis.
Ugh. No.
It's caused by these guys.
I don't know. Demodex I don't want
mites.
It.
I it's just a thing that happens. They're usually not this big though.
Well, that's good.
Usually.
Usually
they're much smaller than this, but they can still cause major problems. And so you need to go get it checked out by an eye doctor.
Okay.
Don't get grossed out.
Get checked out.
Get checked out. All right. Don't get grossed out. Get checked out. To find out more, you go to eyelidcheck.com. Again, that's EYELID check, CHECK.com to get more information about Demodex blepharitis. Well, he just makes me want to go out and tell all the stories.
I know. It's very inspiring for people like us that are kind of artistically inclined anyway. Like, it just makes me want to go do all the things.
I'm always
doing.
Preaching about that, right?
Yeah.
Like, just, you can't, it's so easy to lose yourself in medicine.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't think it's an accident. I think they take it from you.
that was definitely one of the lessons there. So we take a look at a story?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, we got a shout out to Knock Knock Eye.
Hey.
In this story. These are the eyeball specific episodes we've been putting out every week.
Yep,
so
on Thursdays.
This comes from Haley, who is a PA working in HemOnc, so physician assistant working in HemOnc.
HemOnc, hematology
oncology.
So blood cancers.
Yeah, Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And something she learned on the Knock Knock Eye Corneal Abrasion episode. She said, we had a patient in the hospital for inpatient chemotherapy who reported sudden loss of vision. I was able to test the vision with more than just a vision chart and by holding up fingers, something I talk about. I followed the steps you outlined, and this patient had complete loss of light perception. Turns out he had involvement of his lymphoma invading the optic nerve, which is like a big deal.
That's a very difficult thing. I do know
that. He surprisingly responded well to high-dose steroids, which is one way to treat it, for sure. Our ophthalmologist didn't come to the hospital.
Naturally.
But we transported the patient to our local ophthalmologist's office for an additional exam, which is fantastic service. You do get a better eye exam in the eye clinic, I will say that.
Right, because you have all the fancy equipment there to look at the eyes. Is that why?
That's right, exactly. We have a lot of equipment. Thank you for all you do, both in the educational and entertainment sphere. I'm here for all of it, wishing you the best. Thank you so much. And yeah, I always talk about checking vision. You go beyond the eye chart. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will call me. I'll be like, patient couldn't see the big E on the chart.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Like, what can they see?
Right. You should be able to see that.
There's more. Well, yeah, you should be able to see that. But even if you can't see that, can you see hand moving in front of your face? Can you count fingers? Can you even see any light? Right. There's other levels of vision perception. And I can just sense Kristen's just glazing over.
I sure am.
Just not.
But apparently,
like, whatever.
Other people find this interesting because people are listening to Knock Knock Eye. So I'm happy to accept that I'm in the minority.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Thank you, Haley, for that. And nice job.
I'm glad you find him interesting. Somebody needs to.
Send us your stories, knockknockhigh@human-content.com. And thank you all for listening. Tell us what you thought of the episode. I love having writers on.
I know.
Like, they're just very interesting. Just the ability to write a book, I'm always so impressed by.
I know. It feels like such a behemoth project to tackle. Yeah. I don't even know where you even start.
I think that's the key. You just start.
You just write. That's what he said.
You just write. There's lots of ways to hit us up. Email us, knockknockhigh@human-content.com. We also have all the social media platforms out there. Hang out with us and the Human Content Podcast family on Instagram and TikTok @humancontentpods. Thanks to all the great listeners leaving feedback.
Even the mediocre listeners. Thanks to you, too.
The mediocre listeners, as long as you're leaving feedback, we love you. No. As long as you're leaving positive feedback.
Oh, yeah. If you have negative feedback, constructive, we'll take it. But if you're just going to be a troll, then you can move along.
That's right. If you subscribe and comment on your favorite podcasting app or on YouTube and give you a shout out, like @AnnLynn8708 on YouTube said, I hope I am adding to a revolution, Dr. Glock. I give your episodes to my doctors, my patients, and the general public. Thank you for standing up for the humans. thank you. I love that. Yes, definitely give my episodes to everybody unwillingly.
Mm-hmm. That's the best way to do it.
Don't take no for an answer.
Shove it down their throat.
Full video episodes of this podcast are up every week on YouTube @DGlockenFlecken. We have lots of cool perks over on Patreon. You should check that out. Bonus episodes will react to medical shows and movies. So you can hang out with us and our wonderful little community, our little enclave, our village, if you will, where you can find early ad-free episode access, interactive Q&A, live stream events, much more. Patreon.com/GlockenFlecken or go to GlockenFlecken.com. Speaking of Patreon community perks, new member shout out to Heidi D.
Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Heidi. And shout out, as usual, to all the Jonathans. A virtual head nod to you all. Patrick, Lucia C, Sharon S, Omar, Edward K, Stephen G, Jonathan F, Marion W, Mr. Granddaddy, Caitlin C, Brianna L, K L, Keith G, JJ H, Derek N, Mary H, Susanna F, Mohammed K, Avika, Parker, Ryan, Medical Meg, Bubbly Salt, and Pink Macho. Patreon roulette time. Random shout out to someone on the emergency medicine tier. Linda B, thank you for being a patron. Linda, you can be the comptroller in our little community. How about that? We have an open position. What is a comptroller?
I was going to ask you. What do they do?
I've just heard that word.
It just sounds good.
Thank you all for listening. We're your hosts, Will and Kristen Flannery, also known as the Glock and Fleck. And special thanks to our guest today, Dr. Anthony Chinqui. Our executive producers are Will Flannery, Kristen Flannery, Aaron Corney, Rob Goldman, and Shanti Brooke. Editor and engineer is Jason Portizo. Our music is by Omer Vince V. To learn about our Knock Knock Highs program, disclaim an ethics policy, submission, verification, licensing terms, and HIPAA release terms, go to glockandflickin.com or reach out to us at knockknockhi@human-content.com with any questions, concerns, or fun medical puns or jokes or limericks. Anything else?
Well, you just really put me on the spot.
Knock Knock High is a Human Content production.
Goodbye.
Hey, Kristen.
Yeah.
Healthcare workers are struggling these days.
I know. There's a lot of burnout.
A lot of administrative burden that's driving that burnout.
Yeah, it's certainly a major contributor.
Clinicians spend up to 2 hours on administrative tasks for each hour of care provided to the patient.
Yeah, that should not be the ratio.
That's not sustainable.
No.
Fortunately, we have the Nuance Dragon Ambient Experience, or DAX for short.
Oh, is that why you've got your little friend there?
Oh, you noticed.
Oh, I did.
Yes, this is the DAX co-pilot.
He's very cute.
Isn't he? He's got wings. He's there to fly us to a world of less burnout.
All right.
And more efficiency by giving us this AI-powered ambient technology that sits there in the room with you while you're with the patient, and it helps you document the encounter. So you can spend more time developing that patient-clinician relationship.
That's right. You don't have to be looking at your computer. It's capturing it for you.
It's great. To learn more about how DAX Copilot can help reduce burnout and restore the joy of practicing medicine, stick around after the episode or visit nuance.com/discoverDAX. That's NUANCE.com/discoverDAX.